Hi, this is Paul. I wanted to do a video on hardlining and what I'm going to call grime lining. I was looking at what the YouTube algorithm dishes up to me, and I saw whether I didn't watch too much of either of these videos, but one of the ways to grow a big church, get a big following, is to be a hardliner. And this is very evident in Christian circles. Draw bright, hard lines between some people and other people, and you can be very successful. And there are reasons for this. The hard line always sells, and this is true politically, as it is true in religion. Why does the hard line always sell? Well, one of the psychological answers is that we desire certainty as an escape from dissonance. We see all of this complexity around us, and what a hard, bright line does is organize the world. It brings order to the world. There's a line down the middle, there's the right, and there's the wrong, and as long as someone just keeps pushing and asserting that line, and sometimes it doesn't even matter where that line is or how true that line is, but as long as you keep repeating that line and asserting that line, you are the line asserter, and you are the one who brings order to the world. And people find this an incredible relief from the dissonance and chaos that the world is. And so once you draw that line, you will have a following. And if you keep drawing that line, and if you can find enough people to reinforce that line and keep agreeing with that line, you will have a tribe, and you will have a gathering, and things will go well for you. You can be very popular, you can become very powerful, you can become very wealthy. Hardlining is a very successful enterprise. Now, there's a tribal answer for it, too. And now, when I say tribal, I know that in some groups gets to be a negative word. Tribalism is not a negative thing. It's a human thing. It's a natural thing. It's a thing we need. Human beings cooperate in order to compete. You can't grow and develop and learn and live without a tribe. Human beings, it's not good for the man to be alone. This is right from Genesis 1. And so tribalism isn't bad, but it can do bad things and it can get bad. In fact, it's necessary. It's sort of how we Voltron up. It's how we manage to create principalities and around us by which we scale up and we become nations and Uncle Sam and John Bull. And I don't know, does Canada have sort of an archetypal principality that you all name and join up with to exercise your nationalism? But bright, hard lines reinforce the tribe and demand compliance and discipline. Enforcers use shame and pride to hold the tribe together. Now, again, in certain areas of our culture, at least 10 to 15 years ago, these became bad words, especially to certain groups, usually on the left then. Now, one of the things that we've seen in this big inversion is sort of a flip. And so now the other side uses shame. You don't want to be like that person over there. You don't want to be part of them. You don't want to be a racist. You don't want to be a homophobe. You don't want to be a bigot. You don't want to be a sexist. And this is a way to create your tribe, to draw bright lines. And in fact, where there are fuzzy lines, to brighten them up and harden them up so that you can get people to comply and obey and be dutiful members of your tribe. And again, this stuff isn't necessarily bad stuff. We all want to be dutiful members of our tribe because our tribes are valuable to us. And we have many, many different tribes. We have our national tribe. We might have our religious tribe. You have your family tribe. You might have your tribe in World of Warcraft. You might have your tribe, your friend group, and your rival group, your gang of sorts, and just on and on and on and on. This is human activity. And the ways that we enforce and create tribes and manage tribes and battle with other tribes, it's all completely human. And whether you're flying a religious flag or a national flag or whatever flag you're flying, you want to be a good, loyal member of the tribe. And again, none of this is bad in and of itself, but it can get bad and it can get ugly. And hard lines are part of the dynamic here. Now, there's a wisdom answer to this too, which are hard lines exist. There are hard lines. Hard lines divide life from death. And as a pastor or as a doctor, other people, politicians, economists, financial planners, there are many times in life where someone will sit down and give you a hard line. And they do so out of love. And they say, you know what? If you keep going down this road, this will happen. If you're going to need to change your life, change your way, start a new direction. And so hard lines are not the enemy. They are our friend. But we must find them. And, well, I've told the story before of I was in a hospital waiting room with a family, the ex-husband of a woman was dying a rather difficult death to watch. Often in hospitals now, people are on morphine and they're semi-sedated, and it makes for a much more erratic, peaceful situation. But in this case, this man's body was trying to keep him alive, and he was flailing, and it was a very difficult thing to watch. And now the family had, by the time I'd gotten there, most of the family hadn't been members of this church anymore, but they didn't really have any other pastors in their life. And so I get the phone call and I go down there, and you know, I don't go down there and draw a hard line and say, well, you can only call me when I'm your pastor. Now that I'm not your pastor anymore, I didn't play any of those cards. And so I'm there with the family and I'm praying with them and listening to them and listening to their stories. And the brother and sister of the family embrace, and it's a long embrace, and they start singing a song together. And it wasn't a Christian hymn. It was Kenny Rogers, The Gambler. And some of you are old enough to remember that song. You can find it on YouTube. It was a very popular song back in the day. And the song went, you got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, and know when to run. That song is about wisdom, and it's about hard lines. Hard lines are real. The question is always, is the hard line really where the hard liner is pointing? And almost always, the answer is sort of yes and no. The antithetical is real. And one of the recent question and answers that I do on Friday, I'm live streaming them now on the channel in case you didn't notice. I'm usually taking questions from the Discord server. But I often talk about, in my own theological tradition, there was a very big fight that was fought over common grace versus the antithesis. And Abram Kuyper was one of the key lights in the history of my Dutch Calvinist tradition. And, well, Abram Kuyper did a lot of work between common grace and the antithesis. The antithesis says black and white, right and wrong, heaven and hell, good and bad. That's the antithetical. Common grace says, well, God gives his gifts liberally. And you can find both voices, we'll call them voices for now, you can find both voices in the Bible. Sometimes God is very black and white, right or wrong, do this, do that, it's life and death. Sometimes it's very gracious and very forgiving, and, well, there's a time and place for that. But Jesus does the same thing. Jesus is sometimes hated by people trying to draw hard lines and bright lines, and Jesus doesn't follow them or obey them, much to the angst and anger of some of his adversaries. But yet Jesus can get very antithetical. He tells a parable about sheep and goats, tells stories about locked doors, tells stories about virgins who are waiting for a bridegroom who run out of oil, and they go and get more oil, and when they get back, the door is locked, and says you should have been prepared. And so Jesus plays both the antithetical and the gracious, and that is a part of reality. It's not either or, it's both and, but sometimes it's either or, and that's part of why this is difficult. Now, there's also a fashion of making the soft line the hard line, and I hear that, well, black and white thinking is the problem. Well, black and white thinking can be a problem, And it can be a real problem, but ironically, once you state that black and white thinking is the problem, you have just created an antithetical situation. You have just created a hard line. You have just created a bright line. And so you go to people and you say, well, black and white thinking is the problem. And I could say, why are you so dogmatic? I'm not dogmatic. I just said black and white thinking is the problem. Yeah, you're being dogmatic. You can't escape these things. And again, this is also popular in Christian circles, and what tends to be the case is that people get hardline-ish about some things, and they get common gracious about other things. Now, a number of years ago, it was very popular for Christians, they're dealing with just the continued evolution of Christianity in America, and a lot of Christians could be very hardline-ish, and so two types of thinking were delineated, and you can find a little bit about this on YouTube, and you can find a little bit about this with a Google search, but it's basically the difference between bounded set and centered set dynamics, and this became a big conversation in missiology. Remember, I was a foreign missionary for a while, and the study of missions is missiology, and so, of course, I read a fair number of missiological books, and so they would talk about bounded set versus centered set, and if you read books like the Ironwood Bible or a lot of sort of sometimes missionary stories. You know, you have these stories of missionaries who outlaw polygamy and all these sent away wives go hungry and their children starve because the missionary set down a hard line about one wife for you, no more. And if you don't toe this line, God is going to get you, and so all kinds of people suffer. I once heard another story about a culture where the only people in the culture that wore much clothing were prostitutes. The rest of the culture didn't wear a lot of clothing, and then when the missionaries came with their European sensitivities, they saw all these bare-breasted women running around, and they were horrified by this, and they decided that all these women had to be clothed, and what they did functionally was turn all these very decent women into prostitutes, at least in the eyes of the culture. And so these kinds of things abound, and so missiologists would talk about centered set versus bounded set. So bounded set says, here are the boundary markers of our community. People in our community do this, they don't do that. They do this, they don't do that. And that's a very helpful thing in order to say, this is what's in the community and this is what's outside the community. Bounded set dynamics are helpful. But then they talked about centered set dynamics, which you're basically looking at, well, in missiological terms, are people getting closer to Jesus or further away from Jesus? And rather than looking at all these bounded set examples of what people wear or what people say or who people vote for or what people do, it's better to look at whether they're making progress towards the center of your goal, which of course for missionaries was Jesus, or at least especially their conception of who Jesus was. But the more I looked at this theory, I saw that bounded sets and centered sets actually live in the same universe, because their decision about whether or not people were getting close to Jesus had a great deal to do with their bounded set ideas about who Jesus was. And their bounded set ideas about who Jesus was very much moved over time in terms of where sort of the center of this went with respect to all kinds of other complex theories in the theological or cultural evolution of their own tribe. So all of this stuff is going on. And so you're not going to get away from bounded set and centered set dynamics. In fact, they always work together. When the center of the set moves, the boundary set tends to readjust. And so it goes back and forth and back and forth. Now, popular today is the discussion about nuance. And nuance is basically a metaphor that gets into resolution. And again, I've mentioned this many times. When I first started listening to Jordan Peterson, one of the first things I noted, he was talking about high resolution and low resolution. And having played around with computers for a long time and played around with images for a long time, I very quickly knew what he was talking about. With all of the development of screens and JPEGs and photography, that language was very salient to us, and it's a terrific metaphor, and I immediately understood the difference between high resolution and low resolution. Low resolution is really nice if you're trying to create a thumbnail, which doesn't use a lot of system resources in a computer. High resolution is very nice in terms of the granularity of the picture that you see it. Both high resolution and low resolution have their place. And this has a lot to do with hard lines and soft lines. Now, nuance doesn't eliminate hard lines. Nuance just basically, you can look at a hard line, and if you expand the resolution of it, and you can do this with lots of different graphics on a computer, go find a graphic and put it in a window that you can pull and make larger, and you begin to see that, well, this hard line that looked hard from a distance, once you get closer, there seems to be a lot of dots, and there's space between the dots sometimes in the graphics. And it's similar to a metaphor of, well, this little remote control feels very, I should use the cell phone stand. The cell phone stand feels very hard, but when you get down to this subatomic level, there's actually more space between the particles, but, well, my hands are also made of particles, and so you get hardness. So there's a lot going, I can put my, I have to figure out how to use the new little remote. Rick was complaining to me about he didn't like the new lens. He liked it when he could look at and read all the titles in the library, and he liked when the camera was pulled back. And Rick says, well, this is more like coming to your office and sitting for a chat with the pastor. So I put the other lens on and I'm continuing to play with it. But anyway, I digress. Nuance doesn't really eliminate hard lines. It realizes that some hard lines give, in the sense of, if you're walking on a wooden bridge and you're worried about the planks and you kind of bounce up and down, you can see how much it gives. Some hard lines give at higher resolution, but do scale down. And so that's why I want to talk about the grime line. Now, I noticed in the comments section, I do try to read as many comments as I can, that some people said, well, Paul really was excited about Matthew McConaughey's new book after listening to the Jordan Peterson interview. And I was. And so I picked it up. And I often start to listen to books, in the evening. I tend to fall asleep in front of TV, which is a sort of, I'm watching TV with my wife and I pick the program and I fall asleep. She gets particularly disturbed. So then often I'll go to bed and I'll listen to something, and I'll often set the sleep timer and I'll fall asleep listening to something. I couldn't fall asleep listening to Green Lights. It's weird what I can and can't fall asleep to, but it's an interesting audiobook. He reads it himself, and he's an actor, and so, of course, he reads very well. I haven't finished it yet. It's lighthearted, and he doesn't take himself too seriously, even with some of the serious stories. But, part of what I see in this book and what I saw from him in the interviews was what I'm going to call the grime line. So you have the hard line and you have the grime line. Well, what on earth is a grime line? Well, we'll see if I finish the book or not. Sometimes wisdom is knowing when to quit, and sometimes I trust in God's providence for managing my time. Sometimes I finish books sort of right in time when I need them, or maybe that's just a perception, on and on. But I generally like the book, and I like the book, and if you follow my channel, you know what I do is a lot of stories with people. And Sally's story I did just a couple of days ago, and today I just released Alfonso the Drip story. That's his name on the Discord server. And I thought he was unusually capable of sharing his story. Well, Matthew McConaughey isn't doing it, just for an off-the-cuff YouTube conversation. When you do something like this in a book, you have a little bit more time to lay it out and edit it and get it all right. But it's stories are very well told. They're very well told, but they're also quite grimy. And one of the things that I know with my channel is that part of why a lot of you are here is you will say, well, Paul's very real. Well, why is Paul real? It's because Paul has a lot of experience with poor people and mental illness and homeless people and the kinds of stuff that are on the grimy streets of Florin Road, Sacramento, California. And that affords credibility. And there's a degree of that here, too, with, let's say, Matthew McConaughey versus someone like Sam Harris. Sam Harris grew up the son of someone who worked in Hollywood, and you get the sense that, you know, Sam Harris has had I hate when words get colonized by certain tribes and you can't use them anymore. I mean, Sam Harris grew up with a certain degree of privilege in his life. Matthew McConaughey did not. His father struggled to make a living, and the relationship between him and his father was quite complex, whichever relationship is, but it could be violent. His father could be a violent man. His mother was also a character, and I don't know. I tend to be attracted to stories like this, and I think we often are, partly because there's a degree of integrity about it, and to actually figure out what we're thinking about and why this engages us is not necessarily a small or easy thing. But I'm sort of calling this the grime line, because this isn't a hard line story. There are grime line stories tend to be able to incorporate hard line, but also soft line. Okay, so like Hillbilly Elegy, the Netflix adaptation, which I frankly liked. I know it got negative reviews, but I liked it. And I think the reason a lot of people didn't like it was because it was hard to watch. Why is it hard to watch? Because we usually like clean lines in our stories. We like good guys and bad guys. We like the antithetical. And real life is complex. It's grimy. What I mean by grimy? Well, what is grimy? Well, it's granular. You can feel the dirt. You can feel the sand. You can see the muck. And it's just resolution on down. Well, what is muck? But muck is water plus really even finer grains of decaying or particulate material, and it has a smell, and it's grimy. And I think that's part of the attraction to me of Green Lights, and it's part of the attraction to me of continuing to work and live in a neighborhood that is grimy. I grew up in Paterson, New Jersey. Check that off the bingo card. Paterson, New Jersey is a very grimy city. I lived in the Dominican Republic, in the developing world. It's a very grimy place. And you might think of the Dominican Republic, you might think of Punta Cana or Casa de Campo or some of these resorts that you can go to visit. But I didn't live in a resort. I lived in a coastal town and it was beautiful, but Barahona was not the kind of place where they wanted the tourism industry to thrive in Barahona. It never has. It was grimy, and I worked with Haitians. Their life was very grimy, but if you talk to Mary Cohen, she'll tell you that the grime is really important. The dirt is really important. That's where all of the life comes from. And so grime lines have dirt and granularity and reality incorporated in them, and so I tend to like stories that are grimy and dirty, and I tend to like places that are grimy and dirty. Now, I also like places that are clean and orderly, but to me, there is a certain degree of reality and honesty, integrity, authenticity in the grimy and the dirty. And I think this is actually part of the reason that Jordan Peterson struck a nerve when he did, and with whom he did, and why he did, that there's a certain degree of authenticity to his work. Now, I noted today, and Esther pointed this out to me this morning, that the Daily Beast is deciding to, Matthew McConaughey keeps flirting with alt-right darlings. And of course, alt-right has sort of become the boogeyman term of anyone who might be Jordan Peterson or IDW adjacent. And so I'm not a big enough fish to get written up in the Daily Beast, but of course, yeah. But this is, of course, tribal shenanigans. And, you know, I'll look to someone like Chris Sarnati, who was on my channel and who I have a lot of respect for. And when he published his book, Dignity, the whole story of the grime that he was drawn to. And if you look at my conversation with Chris, his father was an immigrant and they settled in this town. And Chris Sarnati's nose for grime and nose for authenticity and nose for truth brought him to some grimy places with people who work in the grime and live in the grime and live in the complexity and the disorder of their lives. And, you know, Esther was, when Esther found this book, she pestered me for a long time. You got to read this book. You got to talk to this guy. And, well, she was right, because she heard my channel and watched my channel and immediately saw the grime line, saw the connection between them. Thing is, you don't have to be religious to be smug. Religious people can be very smug. They can be very tribal. Same thing with politics. Because hardlining is psychologically effective, it appeals to both sides. And so now, in a sense, the left is getting increasingly tyrannical, whereas a generation ago, their big line was "Don't judge me," and now the line is all about shaming and being prideful and people. You know, part of the reason I don't get too disturbed about this is that there's actually a natural dynamic. Self-righteousness, especially in our culture, is a really bad look, and whereas people want order and they do want a degree of their tribe to win, they also really don't like having other people be self-righteous and smug and look down on them. And so in time, that position tends to be a losing position. It loses in politics and it loses in church. Now, part of the problem, too, is that we're seeing the increase of purity culture, and hardlining tends to lead towards a purity culture because more and more things get tapped by the hard line. You can't be in our tribe if you do this. You can't be in our tribe if you do that. So then you get into the whole bounded set dynamics, and then there's this race up the hierarchy to be pure. And the problem with Matthew McConaughey, even though if you look at the movie he made about AIDS drugs, which, I mean, the guy is a phenomenal actor. You're hard pressed to see that movie as sort of a right wing movie. But the thing is, when you get down to the grime line, sort of the right and left tribal polarities begin to lose their power, because you begin to see that people on the left make some arguments that are important. Yeah. Societal pressures are real. Market forces aren't always gracious to people who don't have a lot of power, on and on and on. These are often left-wing arguments. But at the same time, you get down beneath those purity spectrums and you begin to see that, well, you know, what someone does and the choices they do are important. And there are some hard lines. If you get involved with drugs, you may very well ruin your life. If you can't hold a marriage together and your children are the products of divorce, there's a lot of difficult things that come. And so again, hard lines don't go away. Just the resolution gets upped and you begin to have a much more granular, much more grimy view of the world, and at that level of the world, things get very real. So, you know, when Christians hardline self-righteously, self-righteousness is is something that everybody points to. Well, now the other side is doing it too, and again, that shows that these are just natural patterns and dynamics that we tend to perpetuate. Used to be that the left sort of liked the grime line, but the grime line is very high resolution, and hard lines start falling in inconvenient places for low resolution tribal narratives. And that's why, again, in many ways, the personal is the powerful. So the grime line is tiny. Its grime is tiny. It's granular. And it's where hard lines and combinatorial explosion converge to make complexity. And just 2 days ago, I posted my conversation with Sally. And that was often, you know, I watch the analytics on my channel. A lot depends on thumbnails and titles. And of course, I thought this title would at least get some attention. But people were immediately impressed with this conversation and Sally's story, because Sally's story is very real. Now, again, watch the language. It's very grimy. I mean, we like these clean narratives, and even in our own community, clean narratives can develop like, well, I was an atheist, and then I found Jordan Peterson, and then I decided to go to the Orthodox Church, and now things are wonderful. And God bless you. If that's your story, I'm super happy and super pleased, and I want nothing, you know, I want nothing less for you than to find a church, whether it be Orthodox or Catholic or Protestant, but a church where you can go and develop in your life in Christ. I'm a Christian minister. That's my agenda. I'll put it right out there. But I also know that churches are complex, and no priest is perfect, and no church is perfect, and the church is filled with regular fallen human beings. And so, yeah, Jordan Peterson's, we're monkeys filled with snakes. That's how we are. And so, you know, you might discover that Orthodoxy didn't work for you. Well, what does that mean? Where were we getting granular? Now, are there hard lines in there? Or maybe if there's, maybe there's some reasons why it should have worked and didn't for you, and maybe you've got culpability in some parts but not other parts. Well, that's the project. That's the project of a conversation, and it's not the project where I sit down and tell you how to be and what to do. It's a project where we mutually explore together. Because, as I again, I was talking in last Friday's question and answer. One of the takeaways that I got from Jordan Peterson's excellent conversation with Roger Scruton was the whole idea of, you know, most of the reality we see are our projections, and the transcendent, or the truthful, and usually the inconvenient truthful, is the grain that causes dissonance within us, and we start to work on that. So we have to work on our stories. And you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about lately is, what does the world need? The world needs more and better pastors. And I don't say that just to trumpet my own vocation, but part of what I want to at least do some modeling with on this channel, however imperfectly I do so, is, I've been watching The Mandalorian. This is the way. This is what we do. We talk to one another, and, you know, I can browbeat you, and I can hardline you, and I can use all sorts of tricks to try and get you to do what I think you should do. And there are times and places for that. Look at jailhouse preachers. That jailhouse preachers can be enormously persuasive and sometimes tyrannical, because they're trying to often take young men and get them out of gangs and get them off drugs and get them onto a better path. And I've known a lot of jailhouse preachers like this. But often with, in this context, you know, what do? Well, let's talk to one another. Let's, and again, this all sounds so soft, and but it really isn't. Let's ask questions of one another, because it's when I see something in my life that I know I should change. Well, that doesn't mean I will change it. Well, where am I going to find the strength to change? Where am I going to find the courage to change? Where am I going to find the capacity to change? Where am I going to find a context in which I can change? Because, you know, someone getting off of alcohol or someone getting off of drugs, they often have to change their context. They have to change the community of people that they're talking with. And again, this is part and parcel of what church is for. Church is designed to create a community that will be supportive for the positive change in your life. Well, how do you know it's positive? Well, that's part of the thing. It's going to be granular. It's going to be grimy. It's not the hard line, but it's the grime line, which is full of hard lines, but also fertile ambiguity, where you have the space to work on your stuff in order to make progress towards it. And, you know, conversations like these that I do, they don't usually end in some hard line moment where someone crosses a line, crosses a good line, crosses a finish line, as it were. It's usually progress, hopefully, and discovery and insight. Complexity is not mush. Mush is just higher resolution of particulates, usually with water or oil, because oil's more grimy. Oil to sort of lubricate the process by which life and transformation happens, because, you know, life is sort of weirdly anti-entropic. It isn't breaking down. It is building up even as it's breaking down. It's both and. You know, we want to be seen and heard. And joy shared is joy multiplied. And pain shared is pain divided. And so easy answers give way. And often they don't just disappear. You know, maybe you do need to stop drinking. Maybe you do need to go to bed on time. Maybe you do need to pick up your room. And maybe you won't right now, but at least in some ways you're moving towards that goal. There's the centered set idea. But maybe for you, there's going to be a hard line. And you know that if you cross this line, it's a slippery slope on the other side. So you need a little fence and say, there's a hard line for me. And maybe other people, it's not a hard line for. I'm not a drinker. I've never liked the taste of alcohol. I've always found myself quite sensitive to alcohol and found it repugnant. So I can walk through the liquor aisle in the grocery store and not feel a twinge. I have friends for whom they don't want to go anywhere near that aisle because the results are going to be predictable. After the conversation with Jordan Peterson and Matthew McConaughey, True Detective came up, and Matthew McConaughey's take on antinatalism, and someone left in the comment, well, you really got to watch season one of True Detective, and my wife doesn't usually like watching TV that's real rough, but Matthew McConaughey was in it, and the funniest thing about the Matthew McConaughey interview was that the women of my house were like, Matthew McConaughey found Jordan Peterson. Maybe he'll find you. It's like, he's married and telling my wife, honey, you're married too. But because Matthew McConaughey was in it, she agreed to watch the first episode of True Detective. And yeah, I immediately saw the antinatalism connection. But I also, there's also this scene in True Detective when Matthew McConaughey character Rust goes over to his partner's character, played by Woody Harrelson, and they go to Woody Harrelson's home with his wife and his daughters. And of course, Rust had lost his daughter. And so, at least that's what I know after episode one, season one. But, right away, he shows up at the house drunk. And then we learn, alcohol is a tough thing for him. And, well, sometimes people need a hard line in their life in order to manage the other lines. So easy answers give way. I had a friend, good friend of mine, who was a member of this church. He was an elder. I miss him so much. But he had been an alcoholic. By the time I had met him, he had been 25, 30 years sober, and he'd gone to AA for years and years and years and sort of graduated from that. And he said, AA helped me get off alcohol, but I need church to help me with other things. And so he was a member of this church, and he's a very, very addictive personality. When he died, his wife found, toolboxes full of screwdrivers that he was collecting because he just was obsessive about all kinds of things. And addicts are addicts, and sometimes they stay hooked on certain things. He never fixed anything. Wasn't a particularly handy guy, but he had all kinds of screwdrivers. It's like, why? He collected cameras, had tens of thousands of albums and cassette and DVDs and CDs in his house when he died. His poor widow had to manage all those things. But, he'd often tell me that when he and some of the other leaders of AA would go out and rescue drunks, they would take alcohol with them because sometimes they needed a little bit of alcohol to get the guy up off the ground into the hospital before he could detox and rehab. And, easy answers give way. The personal is the powerful. And stories are powerful compression algorithms. And so this is where the grimy really gets real. And that's why we love these grimy stories, because the complexity of life boils into it. So maybe Detective Rust is a really good and really smart detective, but he's got ghosts in his past and a drinking problem. And when he comes up against cases which trigger him, that both drives him into it, but also torments him with his demons. And reading a little bit of Matthew McConaughey's memoir makes you understand why he wanted to get off of romantic comedies. Romantic comedies are in some ways they're just cotton candy of stories because, well, it ends at the climax where true love is in some way validated. They got over the one hump that was the, you know, normal trajectory of a romance. But the reality of something like marriage is, well, a lot of the real work begins after you say, I do, and after you establish a household, and after you, you know, try to make a marriage work, and after, you know, the first year or the seventh year or the 25th year, when you're trying, you know, when both of you have changed quite a bit and you have to recalibrate and you've got children that are dependent upon this union. I'm going to be talking to Andrew Root, who wrote the books on pastoring in a secular age, being a Christian in a secular age, sort of applying Charles Taylor to certain aspects of Christianity. But before he wrote those books, he wrote a terrific book on children of divorce, where he was a youth pastor and he was going into, he made the argument that in some ways, children are, at least in their story verse, ontologically dependent on the marriage of their parents. And when that marriage breaks up, something deep in those children is broken. And I'm often struck how many of the conversations I have are children of divorce. And, you know, I'm not saying that there aren't good reasons to divorce. I'm not saying that divorce isn't sometimes preferable to staying together, but there are consequences, and they're grimy, and they're gritty, and they're lifelong. So the personal is the granule, but the personal is also the powerful. Grimeline stories plumb the depths that we can't and haven't yet mapped or exhausted with the spirit of geometry. We use the spirit of finesse in grimy stories because, well, there's this hard line, but that line gives way and there's another hard line and it's deeper and deeper and deeper. So you continue to drill down into the complexity. And part of the reason that we like stories is because, well, stories help us map the territory, but stories always give us a sense of, as John Vervaeke calls, the moreness. There's something over the horizon, and a good story is always grimy and granular, and that's why it feels real to us, and that's why our brains can look at it and say, yeah. Now, sometimes we like hard line or clean narratives because, again, back to the psychological, there's too much dissonance and we get overwhelmed. So just tell me a clean story. Tell me your story about how your life was a mess and then you found Jesus and were able to get off drugs and alcohol and now you're able to be a good family man and you're able to raise children and your children are doing better and on and on and on. We like that story because that story gives us hope. But in almost every case, if you dive into that story, you're going to get into the grime. And this is part of the problem with Christian propaganda. And again, I sort of teased a video that I'm working on, but haven't really been able to. You know, if I can't complete something to my satisfaction is pretty low. It's that's saying something. But I'm working through the issues of the sexual crisis in the church. And when someone's situation like Ravi Zacharias or Bill Hybels or Carl Lentz or any of these individuals fall or fail, well, now the story's getting grimy. And in some ways, that deeply disturbs Christians because we want clean lines. But as a pastor, I know of my own self, and I know of just about everyone I work with, the grime line is the truer line because no marriage is perfect. All have fallen short of the glory of God. All of our lives are grimy. There's a time and place for the clean story and the grime line, but again, the grime line feels more real. Stories are massive compression engines. They take, and again, that was one of the things that I was struck with my conversation that I posted today, which for you will be, well, I'll probably post this afternoon. You know, my conversation with Brennan, where, you know, a child of divorce, and he told his story particularly well, especially for someone as young as he is. It's a difficult thing to tell your story because you have to massively compress, and, you know, so it's relevance realization, it's massive compression, and to just get the logos of this massive thing, which is even, you know, a 21 or a 22-year-old story. So that's what stories do, and stories give us a sense of the moreness and the suchness. And that's why they're so powerful. And we're fascinated by them because, you know, we can go back and forth, jump amongst the resolution. We can say, well, this is a story about, you know, a young man overcoming the adversities of his life. That's a real quick way to talk about the story. Or we can talk about, this is the story of the young man's continual struggle with, let's say, depression. Or let's say his family. Or let's say not realizing his potential. Or, and that's why stories are both massive compression engines and, you know, incredibly granular and, if done well, quite grimy. Why, and this is to me why a personal God is more powerful than a theoretical God. Because, well, it's harder to tell a story around a theory. Persons lend themselves to story. And stories are all about persons. And again, this is why I remain an optimist and confident about crunchy, that's a word Tim Keller used to use, crunchy Christianity. Why is it crunchy? Why is it grimy? Why is it granular? Because you keep going down in the resolutions and you don't escape the issues, but you have a sense that, well, it's more real because my granular take on my life is very real. And so a personal God who is agentic and arenic just tells a much better story. Part of what happens is we use all this exaptation. I was having a conversation with someone, and it's not unlike many pastoral conversations that I've been having, especially now that we're at a point where many people find it very difficult to live in the imaginary of a very agentic God, God number two. And what I'll often note with them is that you have all of this relational machinery that you employ when you're going back and forth with physical relational human beings. We have that's tremendously well developed in us, better developed than any other creature we know right now on planet Earth. We are enormously sophisticated at human relationships. Well, when we're trying to process the frame of all frames and the agent of all agents, which is even, let's say, a theoretical God, which is a vast construct to try to totalize the context in which we're living. Okay, I just put that in all in theoretical terms. To not employ that, as I've used before, that GPU, to not employ all of the machinery that we use for to exapt all the psychological, relational, biochemical, mental, physiological machinery that we use for these tremendously sophisticated interpersonal relationships, and not to be able to employ that on the big story, on the grand narrative, on trying to deal with the world as it is, well, you're just leaving all that machinery at the table. You're trying to play a very demanding computer game like, well, I don't know what are the demanding computer games now. I just play Civilization. It's not particularly demanding, but something like, see, I can't think of any right now. Call of Duty is one that I saw my boys play for a long time. But try playing these games without hardware sufficient to manage the intensive grime and granularity of the big picture. And so, you know, it was over a year ago now that I had that conversation. I laid out that argument with John Vervaeke, and he made the point at the end, which was quite important. He said, well, this doesn't demonstrate the ontology of God. I said, no, but it certainly leads us to suggest that, in Jordan Peterson's words, acting as if God is real is a very salient point. And there's points to be made on the other side, and I'm more than happy to explore those points, but we'll do so in this realm, which is grimy and granular and intensely relational. And so when people come to me with problems that are really stuck, difficult with them, you know, as Jordan Peterson noted, when you get down to certain levels, you really need to get into the theological, to get down to the foundational. And the theological is almost always embedded in deep stories and stories that have stood the test of time, that have been refined and worked over. All this machinery, we're going to want to employ it to really work on the difficult things of our life. And so, you know, it makes complete sense that in a 12-step program, all kinds of secular people come in and they want to get off alcohol. And what do they say? Well, you've got this problem in your life. You need to turn this problem over to a power higher than yourself. They could have said an agent higher than themselves, an agent higher than yourself, in order to deal with this thing in you that is taking control of your life or destroying your life. And so you're going to use mythological terms. You're going to use story terms. It's going to get grimy. A lot of the clean narratives are going to have to give way to higher resolution for the grime and the muck and the granularity so that you can get down into it to get it resolved. And this, again, to me, is why narrative religion won't go away. And even though, again, I haven't finished Matthew McConaughey's book yet, the patterns of, he obviously had religion in terms of when and where he grew up in the Bible Belt. And, you know, I really liked Brennan's story when he moved from one neighborhood in the city out to a small town after his mother had a better relationship and, you know, afforded the family some more options. And they moved to a small town where there's all these churches. And now suddenly, well, he's going to have to deal with religion. Well, what is religion major in? Well, there's a lot of religious clean lining, hard lining that isn't necessarily helpful, but this stuff isn't going to go away because of how we are wired, because of who we are, because of how reality lays itself out, and our continual fascination with the grime line and how it draws us into itself and why it fascinates us and why it feels authentic and why it feels true, even if it's difficult for us to maintain for a while, then we jump back out to clean lines and hard lines and some of those dynamics in order to manage the complexity. Well, narrative does this in us more widely, better than anything we know. And this is why it's not going away, because of how we are wired and who we are and how we work. So grime line, hard lines, clean lines, and grime lines. That's why I think they operate the way they do.